Welcome to the 254th edition of Europe Calling. My name is Amelie Passmans and I work for Europe Calling. Today I will be moderating together with my colleague Maximilian Fries. I'd especially like to greet our speakers, who I will be introducing in more detail later. Today's webinar is about Syria, a country that is often only spoken about in the context of migration in Germany and Europe. But in reality, there's a whole lot more to discuss. The fall of Bashar al-Assad on the 8th of December 2024 has brought about both hope and new violence in Syria. For more than a year now, the country has been governed by Ahmed al-Ashara. Ever since, there have been repeated unrests, both inside the country as well as in the region. The attack on Iran by Israel and the USA, as well as the retaliation of Iran and its allies, also have a concrete effect on the situation in Syria. That is why we will speak about Syria's history, the reign of Assad, and we will try to take a look at the potential future. What will the future look like in Syria? And for the diaspora in Germany and Europe, how can Syria be rebuilt? And what role will politicians and the civil society play in Europe and Syria? Thank you very much, and then I'll continue. A big thank you to Amelie, who is taking the lead today at Europe Calling. She prepared it and organized it. Thanks to the many donors we have. We almost have 2,000 people. That makes it possible for Amelie and me to do this. So a big thank you to our donor members. And now I have the pleasure of mentioning a few practical aspects. We will be speaking both German and English today, should you require assistance. We have two wonderful interpreters. Simply click on the globe in the control bar and then you can select the language. And as always at Europe Calling, you can ask questions and rate the questions of others. And today we will be using Slido for this. I will post the Slido link into the chat, ask your questions there and rate the questions of others. We have over 1,000 registrations, so we really need your help in light of the many questions we're going to get. So please identify and rate the questions you're most interested in by putting a thumbs up on the tool. And please add your name, because if we constantly have to say anonymous user, things get a tad more difficult. And as always, Europe Calling will be recorded and then posted online on YouTube and as a podcast. Please consider this when asking questions. And this would be it. Now you will be listening to the people you have come to listen to. We're going to start with our first speaker. And because she will be speaking English, I will now also switch to English. So find the right interpretation language.
And I'm introducing Ulla Rifai. She is the Deputy Director of the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in the UK, but as she told me, she's based in New York City, and her research focuses on the international politics of the Middle East, including nationalism, sectarianism, and ethnic conflict, and she will today open this discussion, this panel, and getting us into, or yeah, taking our hand and moving with us into this very important topic. Ulla, thank you so much for being part of this and for starting this webinar with us.
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Max, for this lovely introduction and for inviting me. Hello, everyone. It's actually kind of, you know, hard to talk today without mentioning the war going on right now in the whole region, which would absolutely not only reshape the dynamics, the political dynamics in the Middle East, but it also would have lethal implications on Syria. Back to our topic today, I will start by giving a historical background on Syria, then I will focus more on the current situation. So to start with, Syria's modern history has largely been shaped by colonialism and authoritarianism. As a result, the country lacked a solid state building, which led to weak institutions, fractured nation, and an extremely fragile social contract. Syria and Syrians had a very short political experience from April 1946 after the independence of French mandate / occupation until March 30, 1949, which marked the first military coup carried out by Hosni Zayn. Since then, until now, the country is ruled by military men, and the politics theater is dominated by military men. When Hafez al-Assad, the Bashar al-Assad's father, arrived to power in 1970 through a military coup as well, his primary aim was regime building rather than state building or nation building. He ruled, as we all know, with an iron fist, transferring the country into what was described as Mamlekat al-Samt, kingdom of silence, and Mamlekat al-Khawf, kingdom of fear. Well, in March 2011, the kingdom of silence broke out when Syrians, as we all know, marched into the streets, calling for social justice, for civil rights. Yet the regime responded with what was framed as al-Hal al-Amni and al-Hal al-Askari, military solution and security solution, killing 1 million Syrians, displacing half of the Syrian population, and transferring the country into a battlefield for various state and non-state actors. The conflict reached a stalemate in roughly 2018 when the country was divided into areas on influence, sponsored by regional and international actors, mainly Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Yet this changed after December on December 8th, 2024, the date Syrians will never forget. The quick, smooth, bloodless fall of the Assad regime surprised the world and surprised Syrians themselves, even those who are familiar with day-to-day developments on the ground. In less than 2 weeks, Operation Deter Aggression, Red Al-Adwan, led by HTS rebels, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, took control of the country. There was virtually no confrontation, no resistance. Images, videos of the regime forces fleeing Damascus as rebel entered the capital created kind of a surreal scene, as if one group of soldiers were simply rotating out while another took over a new shift. How did this happen? And why at that particular moment? Well, the answer actually can be found in the broader geopolitical context of the region. The Israeli war on Gaza and later in Lebanon, 2023, not now, shifted the structure of regional alliances and the demise of Iranian influence in the region. However, on this is like the broader geopolitical conflict that paved the way to and pushed for the fall of the Assad. But on the battlefield, three main factors played role in helping to for this bloodless, smooth fall of the Assad regime. Well, first and foremost, neither Russian jets were on the sky nor Hezbollah fighter were on the ground. Both were critical for the Assad's survival during the 13 years conflict. And second, the regime forces themselves on the ground lacked the motivation to fight back or to resist after hearing news that the head of the regime fled to Moscow. They just, decided to flee, no motivation to fight back. However, on the other hand, and that's the third factor, many rebels were displaced Syrians who had been evacuated from their towns and cities during the conflict, and they were driven by a powerful motivation to go back home. How's the picture look like today in Syria? Well, the situation definitely in Syria is far from ideal, which is to some extent understandable in any post-conflict context, and given the legacy of Assad rule, and given also the broader geopolitical context. However, there have been many notable achievements in foreign policy and in diplomacy as well. However, many threats and challenges remain in ensuring a stable transition toward hopefully democracy. There are several security challenges. For instance, in East Syria, there is a risk of ISIS revival and the jihadis, militias gaining power again, alongside tension involving Kurdish forces on the east side. On the west, remnant of the regime, Al-Fulul, remnant of the regime networks, they are still, trying to challenge the current government and trying to launch some attacks. In the south, there are instability areas in Suweida, where Druze communities maintain complex local dynamics as well, and the issue is not solved yet and is not addressed as well. And also, of course, the Israeli forces have conducted operation in the southern border and entered Syria occupied part of it again, and arresting Syrians from their villages, kidnapping them, and establishing checkpoints. Beyond security and security threats, Syria faces deep internal challenges indeed. The first one is state building. And as I mentioned earlier, Syria lacked a solid process of state building. Institutions are weak, and the current leadership has not taken meaningful steps towards reforming or empowering the institution. In fact, there appears to be an intention to maintain control over the institution while keeping them weak. And this is extremely dangerous indeed, because state building is the key ingredient in any post-conflict situation. Institutions are critical to this process of state building and are essential to ensure transitional justice. And this is, again, another internal challenge facing the current government today. We have not seen any genuine steps in this direction. And for ensuring transitional justice, transitional justice, as we all know, is key to in a post-conflict situation, and is key to build social cohesion, social contract as well, rebuilding the trust between the various communities and restoring the social contract between citizens on the one hand, the society, and the state as well. And last but not least, the economy and reconstruction, a major question concerning reconstruction is taking place today. Reconstruction is a very complex, process that requires a clear plan. So far, it seemed that there is no comprehensive reconstruction strategy, neither from the state or from the stakeholders. We have seen some signing of contracts, investment deals here and there have been signed, but they appear to lack transparency, and they are not part of a broader, comprehensive plan for the reconstruction. I'll conclude here so we have more time for discussion, which I look forward to it. Although today, the end of the Assad rule closes a very painful chapter for Syrians and it opens a new era. But whether it would lead for stability, democracy, or for further fragmentation and renewed conflict, well, this depends on how these challenges are managed in the years ahead. I will stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was really excellent in getting us into the topic and understanding the region and the history. And I will switch to German.
Because the second speaker will be speaking German, Bayana Nuß is a doctoral student in political science at the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy at the University of Hamburg, where she's conducting research on the Syrian diaspora in Germany. That will also be the topic of her presentation, I think. She's also an educational scientist specializing in migration and education, and a lecturer and social worker at the International University of Bremen. Bayan, it's wonderful that you are here, and we look forward to your presentation. And we can see you on the slide as well, which is fantastic. A very good evening, and thank you very much for the invitation and for organizing this webinar. I'm very happy to be here, and today I will say a little about the Syrian diaspora in Germany. In the last years, I was able to accompany the Syrian diaspora in different contexts on a volunteering basis, but also in my work, so professionally. And I will speak about scientific studies and proof. And on the other hand, I will also speak about my observations. I will certainly pose more questions than I will offer responses. And I'm just figuring out if this works. Okay, wonderful. In order to be able to speak about the Syrian diaspora, I would like to provide a bit of context with current developments and a few figures in order to take a bigger look. In 2011, in Europe, 300,000 Syrians lived in Europe. And today, it's about 3 million people, 3 million people with Syrian roots. And if we zoom into Germany, it's a bit of a mirror to Europe. Around 33,000 people lived in Germany in 2010, Syrian people, that is, or German people with Syrian roots. And in 2025, we are speaking of 1.22 million people with Syrian roots. 18% of them were born in Germany. And when we speak about the Syrian community or diaspora in Germany, then we speak of a young community, a lot of families with children. In light of the challenges that they encountered also in Germany in 2013, 2014, and 2015, lots of infrastructural challenges and others. And one community that became more visible in the last years, that has become more present and has also become more political, with regards to Syrian engagement, or when it comes to the engagement of the Syrian diaspora in Germany. We have seen 217 initiatives that were identified in 2024. 40 of those have stopped their activities. 30 came from 2011, and some were also founded by the Kurdish community. So there is a lot of initiatives and engagement going on in German by the Syrian community. And perhaps I would like to give a few examples from studies. And what you see here are basically three studies from 2017, 2018, and 2024 that highlight some aspects with regards to the Syrian diaspora. For example, when it comes to initiatives and organizations, they are very diverse, that they also work across borders, so they don't only work in Germany or in Syria, but that they really work across the borders, and that they also have different goals. The first thing that was always mentioned is, of course, to reduce the suffering of the Syrian population. So the aim was always to offer humanitarian help, but to also contribute towards social change, as well as towards a democratic vision for the country of origin. So to work on those aspects. And many activists and engaged people have had different experiences in their organization work. They made experiences whilst fleeing, as well as after fleeing, also in a lot of civil society organizations. And then they had expanded their expertise in Germany on the one hand, but they also expanded the actual work going on in Germany. In Germany, they act as bridge actors between the country of origin and the country of reception. They help with knowledge, with resources, with networks, and they also try to really assume an active role in societal life, in political life. And they try to really be a point of contact, a point of trust for Syrian people. Despite of the different challenges in the political and media discourse, because often when one speaks of Syria, one usually speaks of the security political situation much more so than about other aspects. And the working fields vary greatly. There's a lot of diversity, political representation of interests, humanitarian help, social empowerment, and so on. And I thought that it was a very important information that these organizations were often also founded in Syria or in other countries, also in European countries, and then later on, they are registered in Germany in order to be able to coordinate these transnational activities. And one more information on this. Most of the associations, well, 80% of these initiatives are actually associations that are also registered as such, and they are mainly located in Berlin and in Western Germany. That was a sort of first overview of the current developments of the Syrian diaspora in Germany in order to know a little more about the engagement and organization of the Syrian diaspora. And I would now like to speak more about the diaspora using three aspects, and I'll immediately start with the first aspect. From individual survival towards collective engagement. That is the first aspect. The Syrian Revolution combined with different experiences such as suffering or loss, displacement, war, all of this played a big role when it comes to forming the identity of the Syrian diaspora. And with people fleeing, thinking back at 2013, 2014, 2015, at first, of course, the most important thing were the basic needs. So that means finding a flat, finding work, ensuring that children can go to school, etc. And these topics were really omnipresent in those days. But this time was also very much connected to challenges. So dealing with traumatic experiences, or dealing with the fact that the family was distributed in different countries, or that the migration movement didn't happen at once, or because of one decision, nobody said, "Ah, today I feel like fleeing to Germany." No, it's always connected, or was always connected to different stations, and the Syrian diaspora. Was really influenced by this in the course of time. This has somewhat changed with increasing security for the diaspora in Germany. So Syrian people then also started coming together by founding initiatives, by founding associations, by setting up networks, but also by looking at how can we build bridges towards Syria as well as civil society taking us up. And here one could also speak of transnational digital life. Many activities are still ongoing on a transnational basis via social media as well as different platforms. On the other hand, Many studies also refer to dual engagement. What is extremely important for the Syrian people in Germany, we often call it integration or orientation. Simply the fact that people can lead a dignified life here, but then on the other hand, the promotion of transnational solidarity is also extremely important. So that means doing something and establishing something here in the German context, on a political level, on a societal level, on a cultural level, on a linguistic level, but also tied to a global responsibility. And despite of the challenges, structural challenges, financial challenges, nevertheless, a lot of that work is based on volunteering. A lot of people work as volunteers in these structures, and there's also a great degree of motivation. And perhaps I'll say something about my research too. Diaspora making is a term I want to mention is an important term. And Wendy Perlman coined this term, diaspora making. And with it, she wants to expand the horizon from being reduced to a victim status towards a reflexive, collective ability to act and practices. This could be tied to memories, education, politics, etc. Moving on to the second aspect, or perhaps I could also give you an example here, what Syrian organizations, for example, did 3 years ago when there was the earthquake in Turkey and Syria. What Syrian organizations did, they kept trying to create ties between Syria, Turkey, as well as Germany, and they did so overall in Europe at large. But now moving on to the second aspect, for the Syrian diaspora, for the people in Syria, the fall of the Assad regime was, of course, an important moment, and we just heard it. This was considered a historic opportunity. The Assad regime did not only try to centralize power, to assume it, no, the regime continued, tried to combat any type of self-organization. And that, of course, had its consequences for the Syrian diaspora, but it, of course, also had consequences for the Syrian population in Syria. Because for Syrian people, also for people of the diaspora, Syria isn't only a place that is connected to moments or nostalgic feelings. No, it was always a sort of open-ended political project. And with the fall of the Assad regime, there was the opportunity to be able to negotiate about this project. One could ask the question, what kind of Syria would we wish to see in the future? There are two aspects here that come with this. On the one hand, this was a huge opportunity. And as a person that works in this area, I did a lot of observations. Different areas you could work in, sustainable projects combined with politics, education, cooperation, setting up networks, a whole lot of exchange. For example, that doctors could fly from Germany to Syria in order to organize workshops, etc. On the other hand, it really showed the reality to the diaspora that there are also a whole lot of challenges. Because we learned little from the political culture, i.e., how a compromise is formed, how are coalitions formed, what does it mean to negotiate? What does it mean to take a step forward despite of our differences in order to work together? What does political representation mean? And this is something I observe regularly, that this is always a huge topic. Who's allowed to speak? Who has the capital for it? Who's at the front? Who speaks? Who has contacts to the German or Syrian government, etc. So these are topics that regularly arise. And here, the Syrian diaspora plays an important role because the studies show that, okay, it's still new for the diaspora that we're speaking about a post-conflict context, but for the Syrian diaspora, it's also an opportunity to learn from other diasporas. The Rwandan diaspora, for example, diasporas that have regularly contributed towards their country of origin and really tried to offer expertise and knowledge. They got involved in order to foster peace. But studies have also shown that diasporas can play an ambivalent role, that they don't always contribute towards peace, that they can also contribute towards more conflicts. And here, the Syrian diaspora is also faced with the challenge that it needs to see, okay, what can I learn from other diasporas? What can be our transnational contribution? What is my expertise? What have I learned here? What knowledge have I expanded here? What resources have I acquired that allow me to help? And here, the Syrian diaspora could also do preventative work. And some conflicts were already mentioned, that, for example, you say, okay, come, we can nevertheless speak to one another. Here, the Syrian diaspora can also play a role. And last but not least, my third aspect, and after that, I'll also come to an end. And please let me know if I'm taking up too much time. But perhaps I could say a few words about challenges as well as requirements for action. And I tried to create a sort of model. You see the different balls here where you can see the challenges. And I have organized these or depicted these in four levels. We have the individual reality of Syrian people. That could be discrimination, racism, language barriers, as well as daily experiences combined with exile, with fleeing, with traumas, etc. And here, the Syrian diaspora should also act, for example, by offering support, by building secure networks, by offering services, etc. And then on the second level, we have the inner community challenges, as I call them. These are the challenges that are or arise within the community or already exist within the community. And here, community organizing really plays a crucial role. These could be topics such as political representation or inner community work and negotiations, for example, combined with cultural, political, or linguistic activities and offerings. And then on the other hand, how organizations within the diaspora can work together. And because I've worked on this with various organizations, it's extremely important to work on structures. Many people work as volunteers and require a bit more professionalism. One example is project management workshops that are really helpful, that are organized with different organizations. And then on the third level, we have the challenges within the receiving country, because I also work on Germany in my research. So in my case, it's Germany. And here, it's another huge step, providing services in order to say, okay, we are also political actors. We're not only an interesting group that you can speak about. No, you can also speak to us within the Syrian diaspora. And we can network with other organizations in order to cooperate. Then on the fourth level, we have the political decisions and projects in connection to Syria. And here it's extremely important to have support for democratic processes and transnational projects, perhaps also in cooperation with the German government. And I would like to give the example of the platform A New Beginning for Syria. Where one tries to bring people together from the diaspora and Syria in order to really encourage cooperation, but also to offer financial assistance. So I hope that I haven't spoken for too long, but I would like to ask the following question. How can the Syrian diaspora mobilize its agency and resources in order to overcome the existing challenges and in order to contribute towards the design of the post-regime context? And I herewith come to an end and thank you for your attention.
Vielen Dank, Bayan. Das war sehr, sehr
Thank you
interessant.
very much. That was very interesting. And I'd like to use the occasion here to ask a question, and I'm going to ask it in English.
So as Ola said in the beginning already, you cannot talk about Syria and the region today without taking the current conflicts into consideration. So the question that was asked by the viewers was how do the attacks on Iran influence the situation in Syria for both for rebuilding and then also for Bayan, for you, how is the diaspora affected by the attacks? So I don't know if you may want to start, Bayan. I don't know if Ola is here right now.
Yes.
Ah, perfect. Then you can also
I'm
start.
sorry about that. Would you repeat the question, please? I guess I missed that. So it's about the
Yes.
implication of the current war going on.
Exactly. So what would you say is or is there an effect? What is the effect of the attacks on Iran for rebuilding for Syria?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, it's double edges, So that go ongoing war on Iran and on Hezbollah in Lebanon, both would affect Syria. When it comes to Iran, because obviously Iran is now trying to push the Gulf state, to force them to kind of force the American administration to hold the assault. Gulf states like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, both are the main funders now in Syria. So anything would affect these countries would definitely affect the reconstruction in Syria. The priority for them would be their countries, not Syria. This is when it comes to the Iranian context. When it comes to the war that's now in any minute, Israel will bomb Dahiyeh. When it comes to the war on Hezbollah, it would definitely affect the Syrian post-conflict situation. One, it's the security risk at the borders. Two, it's the radicalization, the sectorization would escalate, throughout the Syrian war. Hezbollah played critical roles in sectorization the conflict, as sending Shia militias to kind of kill mainly Sunni rebels, and in many areas in Syria, like in Al-Qusayr, in Hamas, and Rastan, there is a collective memory of sectarian violence by Hezbollah militia. So the situation in Lebanon, in bordering Lebanon, would definitely affect Syria, security-wise, sectorization-wise, rebuilding the trust, social cohesion, and also in Iran, because as I said, it's connected to the economic situation in the Gulf. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you, Ola. That was indeed, yeah, you show it really affects it on a multitude of levels. Bayan,
And now we can maybe speak German again. How is the diaspora hit or influenced? What happens in around Syria now mean for the projects you're working on? Well, they are not more than there are more than thoughts. You could talk a lot about the actual events, and things happen very fast, faster than you can think sometimes. But I'd say everything that happens in the region influences the Syrian diaspora at the individual level, i.e., that there were many people who, after the Ramadan, would go to Syria in the vacation, have already paid for their flight, and so on.
So for their plans, this means that they have to be changed. That's one thing at the individual level. But on the other hand, something which I'd like to say from my perspective, which is a very reduced direct perspective, I have to say, what I've noticed lately is that there is also a schism in the Iranian in the diaspora, because in the Iranian diaspora, because some applaud the attacks and others consider it a war, an attack on their country. And this schism is something which I think is also important for the work of the Syrian diaspora for the work with other diasporas, because this cooperation is also very important for the Syrian diaspora. And such topics, like, for example, also political participation, political education. Well, if you participated, we don't say you have to be a Syrian if you want to participate. No, all the minorities, also from others, foreigners, and so on, could also cooperate with one another, do cooperate with one another. And this means that the Iranian diaspora, from what I believe with my limited perspective, this all has really a great influence on the Iranian diaspora, but also on the Syrian diaspora. And then the media, the politicians, they focus on certain issues, and well, sometimes only the background is considered, which is also important for this whole work, also with Syrian international projects. Thank you very much. Thank you very much also for this answer. And now, after these questions, we can welcome Salam Said, researcher, political counselor, and economist at the Friedrich Ebert Foundation. Her priority is the economic recovery after the war and the recovery in Syria. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really pleased that I can participate here today. And I'd like to structure my contribution into two parts. I would like to continue where Ola and Bayan ended. My first part would deal with the reconstruction of Syria. And in the second part, I'd like to speak about the role that Germany and Europe play. As Ola said already, the reconstruction process is a very complex process, not only economically, that you have to, well, rebuild the buildings, set one stone on the other, so to speak. But there are more levels of this reconstruction. State building is one of them, to reconstruct all those structures, then social reconciliation between the communities, various communities. This is also part of this reconstruction process. And this means that also the political process is very important for the reconstruction. We as researchers think or see that since the fall of the regime and since we have the new government in Damascus, that the Al-Sharaa government has discussed a lot. They said a lot, but the reality between what they said and what they have done so far is immense. Fight against corruption, for example. There is still bribery in everyday life in Syria. Maybe a little bit less, but we still observe that that nepotism is once again very strong in Syria. Within 1 year, we saw that a patronage network was built up in the economy, and this network is very influential also towards state institutions, and it weakens them because they are those who should try to contribute strongly to the reconstruction process. There are also parallel institutions, and which have been built up now, and they weaken the traditional institutions for reconstruction and development, or certain authorities which don't have a clear role anymore, don't know whether they still play inside the state an important role. And we observe that there is an inner circle around the president personally. Key positions are distributed in this way. There is the Economic Council, for example, which we had in the old regime, set up by Assad, but now we have the brother of the current president, who is the president of this Economic Council. And that's why it is. This can be explained that on the one hand, many Syrians are happy that Assad is gone. Many Syrians observe the new developments in Syria, also quite worried, because they fear that the old structures will be continued, that the unjust structures, which led to the situation in which the revolution came about, that people took to the street, that those structures will be revived, and that this will mean that stability will not be possible in Syria. Additionally, the current government is actually implementing a wrong economic policy. They continue Assad's economic policy, and social groups are not taken into consideration by them. Dismissals were numerous in the state sector. The state doesn't feel responsible, for example, for the service provision in the country, for the normal population. And especially in the past weeks, we noticed that thousands of Syrians protested against the high electricity prices, but also teachers are on strike because they have not been paid their salaries. Thus, after 1 year, there are still differences in the salaries between Damascus and other cities and the rural areas. The rural areas are sometimes neglected altogether, and that means that people are afraid that there's a huge difference between rural areas and the cities will continue to be a problem, and that the new state will not devote enough attention to them. Many Syrians were euphoric at the beginning, and when a lot of projects were organized by the Gulf states with financial support, millions of dollars, that's when the people thought, yeah, we have a good future, we will have jobs, we will have good lives in the future. But so far, not much of those hopes have been fulfilled. There are mega projects, yes, but it's difficult to imagine how they can be implemented in a country like Syria, where infrastructure and institutions are lacking, where maybe the institutions that exist are not able to administer such huge amounts of money. And on top of this, you have the military operations that still go on. You have the unrest that still exists in parts of the country. Well, you don't have the Assad regime anymore, but there are still military operations which take place. We saw it in the northeast, and we saw it in the south. We saw it in the coastal region, and nearly daily there are attacks from the neighbors, from Israel, for example. And all these military operations are destabilizing Syria, not only politically, but also economically. But who, because who wants to invest in a country in which you know what will happen tomorrow? Whether the war, which we have at the moment, does not lead to more fragility and does not fragilize the country even more. In Damascus or in the Damascus region, there were rocket strikes, but also in other areas in Syria. And now I'd like to pass over to my second part, and I'd like to talk now a little bit about the contribution or participation of Germany and Europe in the Syrian reconstruction. I think that Germany and the EU can play an important part when it comes to reconstruction in Syria. The leadership in Damascus so far has no clear plan for a reconstruction. They don't have a clear economic policy. Although they seem to have neoliberal tendencies, but that's not an economic policy. They don't really have a vision or a strategy for the economic development in Syria. And there are no transparent governance or structures. You don't have skilled labor because the skilled workers were lost during the war years. So people don't have the knowledge or the experience that would be necessary. And they don't know how to deal with financial resources. At the same time, the European experience and all the well-qualified Syrians who are in the EU now, they could all play an important role. We have heard that highly qualified Syrians do live in the diaspora in the European countries who are highly motivated, who want to go back to Syria and help to reconstruct their country. They want to be part of this reconstruction process in Syria. However, there are many hurdles set up by the government. Unfortunately, the government implies a very strict top-down approach. And this undermines all those processes which would be necessary. The qualified people, the skilled people would like to go back into Syria and help, but Syria doesn't really open the door for them. They are not welcomed with open arms, or at least not with open doors. And this is another problem in the current context in Syria. What is also problematic is, as I've said, that the government has taken a liberal economic course, which is not really ideal for a post-conflict country. I mean, 90% of the population in Syria is either poor or depends highly on international aid. International aid, which doesn't mean aid supplies, not that's not what I mean. I'm not only talking about the internally displaced persons, but normal families who have difficulties to pay their bills at the end of the month. And then, on top of all this, there is, as I said, the infrastructure problem. A lot of the services do not function. Then you have the high inflation, you have unemployment, and other economic problems. Which are still a day-to-day problem, everyday problem for Syrians, even now, 1 year after the fall of the Assad regime. So, perhaps briefly now on Germany's policy or politics towards Syria. Germany is committed economically. Before the war, Germany was one of the largest donors for Syria. through the financing of various development projects. Today, Germany would like to continue to support Syria, and some projects have already begun in the health sector, in urban planning, for example. Germany funds already some of those projects, and maybe later we can talk a little bit more about urban planning and the development of the regions and cities. So Germany is part of the whole process, one can say. And as we've heard from Bayan, in Germany we have the largest diaspora community of Syrians in community. So the connection between Germany and Syria has been strengthened through the fact that more than 1 million Syrians live in Germany. But despite the will to help for the reconstruction, the areas of governance, human rights, corruption, and so on, and the lack of participation are problems. And that's why we have to ask whether this support, which we will send to Syria, will really benefit to the general population and not only the elite. So the question is, how far can we trust this government? How far can the donors and the supporters trust this government and really believe that the whole of Syria will benefit from the money and the help they send to Syria? It is true in Germany, you have this discourse since the fall of Assad and also in other European countries that we discuss about the status of Syrians, about the possible return. But I can say that Syria is not a safe country yet, especially for minorities. We have had the massacres on the coast and in other regions. And then there have been targeted attacks on women in the entire country, which shows that Syria is still unsafe, especially for certain groups of people. And even if the government is willing to protect those people, they so far do not really manage to do so. There are many Syrians who need this protection and therefore would like to stay in Germany or in other European countries. And those who do not belong to groups at risk in Syria, also for those, the return to Syria is not easy at the moment. 1 year after the fall of Assad, there are still no functioning infrastructures who are available to all those who return. The hospitals are a problem, electricity is a problem, and I can imagine that for a family with children or also with older people, it is currently quite difficult to return to Germany. And that's why the whole debate on the possible return of the Syrians too early at the moment. Young Syrians who dared to return to their country because they really wanted to help and be part of the reconstruction, well, they have the challenge of maybe not finding work. But the Syrian community in Europe has been really committed, invested a lot of strength and experience. But in Syria, more and more, they see how little space they have for social commitment, cultural commitment, and whatever. They notice that there are lots of hurdles in Syria, and this is a deterrent for many young people to return to Syria, most of all for women. This is something I can say from my own experience. Germany, in many sectors or areas, as regards Syrians, has programs which sometimes existed already before the fall of Assad, but some of the programs have been discontinued now. and now the asylum requests are checked a bit more thoroughly. But there is also the consensus that certain population groups at risk, like minorities, for example, now after the massacres that happened last year, that those groups will still receive protection. That's all I wanted to say, and now I'm looking forward to a lively debate. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this perspective, also with regard to what Germany can do.
Well, we have quite a few questions, but they're not so actually not so. So Amalie and I looked at the questions, and we said like it's actually not so many questions, but many great questions and many very big questions. So we will be very easy to fill the next 40 minutes until we need to close with excellent questions. And our audience was able to vote, upvote the questions, and so we're gonna start off with the most top voted question. And there's probably a question that maybe Ola, you can start to answer first, and then we'll just do it like we're just gonna open a few questions, and then whoever wants we will give the question to one person, and if the other person wants to add something to it, just raise your hand with like the little hand symbol, and you just add to it. But we don't have to all answer a question, because sometimes you know that's then too much. So with this that said, let's start with Marcus. So Marcus asked, how can anyone trust al-Sharaa, a former terrorist member of al-Qaeda? His HTS militia released Islamic State terrorists when taking over prisons after fighting against Kurdish-controlled Syrian defense forces. Just wearing a shorter tie and a shorter beard doesn't convert a terrorist to a democratic leader. So I think that's a question that, you know, comes often. I think maybe Ola, and maybe then after Salam, if you want to add something to it, and of course, all of you.
Yes, sure, of course. First of all, let me thank all speakers for such inspiring and fascinating talk. So yeah, actually, this question has been asked to Sharaa himself every single time. And my answer would be, yes, he was an ex-jihadist. But you know what? If you go back to his history, when he went, and that's what he's mentioned to in a BBC interview, when he was still in Aleppo in December 2024, before heading to Damascus, when he went to Iraq, when he took the bus from Damascus to Iraq in 2003, he went not because of an Islamic ideology or motivation. He went there to defend Iraqi against Americans. So it was kind of an Arab nationalist, you know, motivation. And there in Iraq, he got radicalized, you know, because, you know, the history of the US-UK invasion of Iraq and what the implications of radicalization, Islamization, that it happened. That's having said that, I'm not saying that he's not an ex-jihadi. Yes, he is an ex-Salafi, ex-jihadi, but he's very pragmatic, unlike other jihadis. So he's shifting his agendas, how to trust. We have a trust issue here, but not between a Sharaa and the international community, obviously, because the international community welcomed him, and the great power, the Americans, the European, he went to the Elysee, he went to Kremlin, he went to the White House. So we're not talking about building the trust between the international community and the Sharaa himself, because it's already been built, I guess, as for now. And we're talking about trust issue between Syrian and al-Sharaa, Syrian and the current government, the government now today in Syria. We're talking about rebuilding social contract. In Arabic, it's al-aqd al-ijtima'i, and social cohesion, al-tamasuk al-ijtima'i. And this is a long, long process that should be embedded in state building, in institutions, you know, that the authority itself, not with the Sharaa alone. It is for now. I hope I answered your question.
Salam, you want to add something?
Yeah, I can even just a few words. I think the problem with Ashara is not his past as a jihadist, but his practices and his behavior since he is in power as a president. As I mentioned, he has a very centralized approach of power, and he is authoritarian. So there is a lot of we see this authoritarian practices coming in Syria. So the problem is not in the past. The problem is now, and how to win trust with the international community. I disagree that yes, that's true that this international community is trusting him, but not for forever. So it dependent on his performance. And so if his performance, he is not in the position to protect minorities, he's not in the position to protect women, he is not in the position to participate to have a like participatory process of the politics, but also in the economics. So this trust will that's reduced and then might be go at some point, be begun at some point. This is the issue I want to emphasize on about the trust. And yeah, he did a big mistake that he put a lot of efforts to get this trust from the international community while disregarding and ignore the trust of his own people and his own country, to be honest. Yeah, this is
So maybe Mbe can extend the question a bit, like, because you both spoke about state building institutions now. So when now it's more than a year now with the new government. So how are the plans for how are political parties forming? So is there are there seats for, you know, party politics, for a republic, for elections? So what is going on there? Are there formations of this? Because, you know, there has only been one party, right? And so how is there, has democracy itself, is anything developing, and is there kind of a roadmap to elections, to parties and things like that?
Do you want to start, Ola,
Yeah,
or
you
should
can
I say?
start. Yeah, go ahead.
The first thing what has done actually Sharia when he came to power is like to dissolve all the party and also all the legal, let's say, framework, which like be able to create a party. You cannot create legally, you cannot create a party now in Syria, even with a lot of Syrians prepared and want to register parties, but there's no legal regulations for that. This is the one thing about the parliament. There is a parliament which is directly and indirectly appointed by the president himself. So as a third of the parliament should be appointed directly from the president, and the two-thirds appointed by committees which are appointed by the president himself. So this is what I'm talking about. This is a centralized approach in the governance and in the institution. So this is why there is a fear to go back to the one party, one president, one person controlling everything. But Aula can maybe
Yeah, I'll just add a few words. So, as Salam said, there's no parties now. Unlike the past, yes, it was only Baath Party. We used to have some, kind of a decoration like the Socialist Party and the Arab Nationalist Party. But actually now, and here I'm not saying that it's not important. Of course, we need a political platform. So we kind of, reduce the risk of polarization we have in the society now. So instead of people going to social media, they can do their, as a platform to for their opinion or to the ground, So I guess it's we do need political parties. But I guess now we have to two process. The first one is the transition from conflict to post-conflict, from conflict to kind of stability. The second one is transition from conflict, authoritarian state to kind of a democratic, environment. They are not there. They interrelated, but they are not the same. And we are still didn't move forward in both of them. We still, as Ammar said, as Selam said, as Bayan said, the still the situation security-wise in Syria is not stable. So still trying to move from the conflict, post-conflict, and of course transition to democracy is not only very, it's a long, road, it's a process. And this process should be embedded in state building, should be embedded in institutions. They can ensure, a stable transition, hopefully, toward a democratic state. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I think the second most upvoted question, or rather questions, kind of also goes in hand with this. We mentioned before that there's somewhat of a top-down approach a lot of the time when it comes to transitions. And so the second question actually is, what does the Syrian society want? I know it's a really big question, so maybe we can say from your perspectives, what are like the most important points at this stage? And then also maybe for Bayan more specifically, how does this also apply to the Syrian diaspora, and how is the communication and connection between the two?
I'll just
Oh,
say a few
if anyone wants to start.
words on that top-bottom approach. Yes, it's a top-bottom approach. I do agree with you. However, after the fall of the Assad, we can see the bottom up. Civil society trying to jump in and taking place. So in on the ground in Syria, and I'm sure that Ammar can relate since he went to Homs and to Aleppo, you will see those young Syrians who are passionate, eager to take role in the state building, in reconstruction, and to get involved in the political life. This is something very new to us Syrian who lived, for long under an authoritarian state. We don't participate in any type of, activism or even that this in, civil society or civil movement. So there is kind of a bottom, up. But is there at the grassroots level what I mean? But the question is there an interaction between the grassroots level and the top? Not really. And this is where, again, state building and again, building the social contract between the state and the society. I'll just stop here. Maybe they can add more.
Yeah, thank you. Indeed, if anyone wants to add to the question, or also Bayan, if you know anything about the diaspora and the connections and how that can maybe help the bottom-up approach.
In the connection with the government, you mean?
For example, but also with the people in Syria, like both.
I think on the one side, the Syrian diaspora in Germany, for example, started already their project with Syrian in Syria with those transnational projects and healthcare, trauma healing, memorizing. Some very different fairs and something like that. On the other side, I think it needs a little bit time and maybe other communication methods and ways to communicate with the government because there is those or there are those two methods in the building the political representation of the diaspora. On the one side, we have this bottom approach. So, from our projects, from our engagement, from our work, we can build. We can build. How to say that? So. This character of people who can communicate and to present us in the communication with the German government and the Syrian government. And we have the other method from above, And Unfortunately, we saw some examples from the above method. So I spoke with the German government and on the other side with the Syrian government, and they told us we should build the Syrian organizations to be able to do this and that. And I think it's a little bit dangerous to have just one method, because if I would go back to the two pictures with which Ammar showed us at the beginning of his presentation, we showed the first picture with just men, no diversity, and so on, because it's from above. And we saw another picture, very diverse, because it comes from people. And I think maybe we cannot erase one method completely and say we don't need this from above, but I think we, or the Syrian diaspora, has to play this big role to say those are our people who worked since years with us in this society and with the Syrian society, and we need them because they can address our problems, and they can communicate in our names, I think.
Maybe one more thing that I just want to say that the Syrian society showed a high degree of resilience during the war, and there were a lot of initiative at a local level. Even under the authoritarian regime, they tried to do a lot of things under the radar. This is the name what we use it always, because they want to work, but at the same time they cannot do that. I do agree that there is a lot of initiatives going on now, and a lot of even role of the society in the development domain, but which is desired even from the government, is even encouraged because the government doesn't want to put a lot of efforts doing that. But it's at the same time, there is a little space for the other engagement, like the political one. Do you know? It is like two things which we see, because these people who are engaged in providing initiative for education for children, for example, or for women or whatever, they know that if they want to have a like real change, they have to be involved in the politics. But when this come to, and they are ready for establishing a party and trying to have a like to go into election, to go to the parliament, to have a like more participation in the decision-making process, they haven't a place, they haven't a door, they haven't a channel to get there. This is the paradox we have now at the moment in Syria.
I want to jump in here and connect Amma, connect you into it, because you have kind of also you showed us some kind of practical work about getting like the local community involved and getting to start and work and think how to do reconstruction on this very local and localized level. So my question would be like, with the workshop you did, and in a city like Homs, for example, like what are the next steps now? So you made this workshop, there are ideas and the maps, right? And how is now the next step? Is there a like a mayor or a governor of the city of Homs, where then the architects and you will present your plans for a kind of for this kind of reconstruction? Or is it all so centralized that everything is decided in Damascus? So how to go about it? I'm here in Düsseldorf, right? So it's like when we want to rebuild a house, there's a city council and then the different committees. Of course, once it gets very kind of complicated. But how is the situation? How is something like, let's rebuild a city quarter? How is that kind of at the moment organized now? How should it be organized in your sense, like in a city like Homs, for example?
Yeah, I think like in I want to like recall a proverb or like a quote that a friend of my father told me when I told him, "Ah, oh, it's nice to see some people building their home by themselves." And he told me, "Wardu which means a rose and two roses don't make spring." And I was thinking a lot about this because it in somehow it makes me think about the role of the grassroots and the bottom up.
We can make a team like the six of us and go and say we want to do something. We can do things, but then you have an entire neighborhood destroyed. You do need like a reconstruction at scale. We cannot just rely on a grassroots or like a small team to do something. But then when I was thinking a little bit more about a rose and two don't make a spring, I thought, but they start the spring. And then somehow, when you are looking at what the great initiatives are doing, and there's an explosion of like a great work happening at the moment in Syria by, diaspora and people inside the ground, or like sometimes together, it's a great. And just to reflect on the architecture reflection, for instance, there's an organization called Syrbanism that has been working from Germany, and now they are working inside the country, and by Noor Harestani and I think Edward Hanna. And then also there are colleagues who are living abroad, like Together Space by many colleagues who are living in Germany and other places who are doing workshops inside the country now. So there's a lot of transformation of this knowledge from outside to the inside and vice versa, from the inside to the outside. And I think like in my situation as somebody who is in academia, I wanted to really make a tour of this workshop and do it in other cities. The plan was I was working on this with Al Majlis Al-Shi'i in Salamiya, the Shia, let's say, institute or council in Al Salamiya, which hosts a largely Ismaili community inside Syria. And I wanted to do exactly the workshop instead of doing it in Homs to go to Salamiya. And the idea was to go then to Hama. And then the idea is to go to places like Jebli and other cities on Tartus, the places that they aren't getting attention from, international and local organizations. The problem is that, linking it to the bigger question of what's happening in the war, I don't know if I would be able to travel in April or not to Syria within the current situation. I don't know if I would be able to do so. But in the ideal scenario, then I would love to see these workshops happening in many different cities. I would like these cities to be these workshops to be translated into curriculum and educational programs that they could be taught every year, so we can have something sustainable and long-term and repetitive, so we don't just do something and leave and say, okay, we've done, we ticked the box, but rather they would be benefiting hundreds of students every year if we are developing these educational programs. But if we want to blend it to practice, then I would prefer, and I'm in the current dialogue with the UN, some of the UN agencies inside Syria, is to see how can we plug in the work that we are doing in the university with institutions such as the Aga Khan Trust for Culture, or for instance with the UN agencies or the local governance, etc. And how can these voices could be embedded? How can they be embedded within the work in practice? So we don't have these big companies coming and say, oh, we're gonna destroy more of your city in the name of reconstruction, but rather we can listen to the voice of people and protect what remains of what we have.
Yeah, thank you very much. Excellent answer. Thank you.
I would like to open a new box of questions because we have a question from Heiner about the Syria and the Syrian community and if it's also torn like in so many other countries. So, for example, between left and right or between minorities. And I think this opens the question of sectarianism, and it was also a tool used by the regime and by other players to keep people down and keep them apart. So the question that we also got from Silvio as well is, how are these conflicts now? Because there have been a lot of reports about conflicts based on religion or ethnicity. So yeah, what kind of is the vision for a more united Syria out there?
I can say a few words if you want. So yeah, so during the conflict, the uprising, which turned into a multi-layered struggle for power between domestic, international, regional actor, state and non-state actor. So during the conflict, there was a process of sectorization by the regime, by the Assad regime on the one hand, and by other actors, state and other non-state actors, by Iran, for instance, to some by Turkey as well. So many actors, they engaged in this kind of daily reconstruction of sectarian identities, of Sunni identity. When we talk, for instance, about Sunni identity, it's not one identity, it's identities. You have many versions of Sunni identities, Salafi identity, jihadi identity, Sufi identity. So they're not a solid community, you know. unlike other sectarian identity like Christian, Druze, or Alawite, which to some extent represent a solid sectarian community. So yes, during the conflict, there was a process of sectarianization from above, and also directed from above, and also from below at the grassroots level. We see many sectarian practices on a daily basis, like looting at sectarian from sectarian motivation. During the conflict, for instance, many areas that was dominated by Sunni, they got looted by sectarian militias, by Alawite militias, by Shabiha, and then they would sell the stuff in a market called the Sunni market. We have now an Alawite market, for instance, after the clashes in the coastal cities. So what I wanted to say is this process of sectarianization and of identity clashes at a daily level, it's still taking place. It's taking place by material structure and also by symbolic factor. By material structure, by media, army, we see a lot of, armed militias, from all sides, from Druze side, from Alawite side, from Sunni side. They are all jumped into the identity clashes now, armed. How to do that? How to start a process of de-sectorization? It should be again through state building. So the state should be, it's we can't build a country based on ideology, like Islamic ideology or even Arab nationalism ideology, because every ideology would rise and demise at a particular political moment of history, as we're seeing now, for instance. We have to have, citizenship to base, and this is embedded in state building again. So when we walk toward a genuine steps towards state building, towards citizenship rights, that way we can counter the sectorizations going on now.
The one point with the sectarianism is just like not a new that power used sectarianism to size power, like since the colonial time, and they have been used in Syria and in the other countries like that, where there is a lot of sects or a lot of diversity, let's say. The problem in Syria that these sectarianism have been used by the regime, by the opposition during the war, and now also in what we have seen in the Sahel and in Ceuta in the south, and also even against the Kurds in the northeast. The problem is it is not the sects themselves. The problem is that the state failed until now to build like a national identity, to be inclusive, that everyone, like Ola said, on citizenship, your belonging to the state of Syria, it is not because you are Sunni or Alawite or Arab or Kurds, because you have the citizenship. This is missing, still missing, and the state has any the government, the leadership in Damascus today failed to do that, and we witness hate speeches, and it's all in all communities against all these communities, and this is will not bring Syrians to nowhere. Like that is the any. Will bring us to more division and more fragmentation if this not yani be done by the state itself.
Can I also add something? I think I just want to echo what my colleagues have been saying. But I think, like, in addition to all of this, we need to think of reparations or jabr al-darar. What does reparations mean for people who lost a brother or a sister or a mom or a father? And I think if we think about the many reads that we have said inside the reparation, I mentioned remembering the absent and remembering that's appeared in the dead, but there's reparation, which in many contexts, I'm not a lawyer or I don't know about, the legal aspect of it, but it does include the question of restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, measures of satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition. And a minimum part of all of this, it's about acknowledgement to what happened. In Syria, like after 500,000 people being killed, nobody is responsible. Like nobody is acknowledging that they have done what they have done. Nobody came to apologize. Nobody came and say, I have done what I have done, you know? So this absence, this lack of acknowledgement to anything that's happened from 2011 till now, it makes us like go in this cycle, you know, there's this void that it seems like the city is covered by a ghost of death and fear, and nobody wants to say what's happened and what has, you know, has been happening, you know. And I think without this justice, we can just pretend that we're burying the war below the carpet, as they say, and we're moving on. But it doesn't work like this because you need to face what happened. You need to make people feel that trauma they have experienced is visible and seen and heard. Not it's abused now, as what we are seeing in the Ramadan TV shows, that the trauma is taken into a drama show. And the TV show to make money and to make viewers see the prison, but it's in a genuine, effective way to tell people we acknowledge what happened and we want to move towards reparations and social justice and transitional justice. In that case only, people would be able to say, I'm from this sect or that sect, and I belong to a bigger idea than just my sect, my tiny sect, you know? Like when we are in diaspora, you see how we melt with all these tens and tens of nationalities, you know? It doesn't matter. We're all like, you know, working together. Why, when people are inside their country, they cannot do that? Because there's this fear. There's historical, as Ola said, historically, this idea of sectarianism has been politicized and abused throughout history. And how we can undo what has been done so we feel like we belong beyond just our own tiny sect or the tribe that we belong to.
Yeah, interesting that you also mentioned the diaspora, because part of the question was also directed specifically towards that. So, Bayan, I would like to ask you, how are the dynamics in the diaspora? Is it like more sectarian? Is it different initiatives by people belonging to different sects, or is it a combined effort? Maybe also, like, what does your research say about the collaboration?
Maybe I would like to go back some years ago, 2011, 12, 13, 14, and so on. And what studies showed that revolution, displacement, loss, very difficult experiences had always collected people together beside their sects and so on. So for them was our pain. A very collective or a collective identity for them. But when the conflict continued, we came to fragmentations in the Syrian diaspora, in Europe, in Germany, and so on. And I think now, after the fall of the Assad regime, we have still those fragmentations because what Ammar said, because of denial. Because so many people wouldn't acknowledge what happened at what is now happening. And I think on the other side, maybe the Syrian diaspora has this big challenge to go from reaction mood to action mood. And I would give this example about or to the visit or the invitation of Friedrich Merz for Ahmed Scherer to visit Syria. And I could observe how the Syrian diaspora react to this. Instead of saying we have some interests points, we would discuss them with Ahmed Scherer and also with the German government. They invited to two separate demonstrations. On the one side, people who would welcome Ahmed Scherer in Berlin, and on the other side, people who don't want to welcome Ahmed Scherer in Berlin. And when I think about that, it for me and in my eyes, it was so difficult for the Syrian diaspora and for its existence in Germany, because they would give a reason for the right wing to say, what are you doing in German streets, and to come to conflict and so on. And I think it's very dangerous for the Syrian diaspora, for the whole society, and they are a part of the society. So I think on the other side, we should address our subjects, and we should look at our subjects in the German society and beyond, and go from this reaction to the action to address our points and our cases to, and to communicate them with the German society, with the German government, and also with the Ahmed Sharia. And I think this is very very important, because instead to say we have a Syrian diaspora from 1.22 million people in Germany, we have some small groups, because this group wouldn't acknowledge the massacre to the other group, and so on. And instead of, because the Syrian diaspora worked already together, and I read so many really, I would say so cute posts from so many Syrian people who said, let's come together, because at the beginning we visited German courses together, Kurds, Druze, Arabs, Sunni, Shia, and so on. We were together in the same situations. So what has changed? And I think we should address this question many times, and on the other side, not to be this mirror of the Syrian government without diversity. We have this diversity in Germany, and we could work on it. It's hard, because every person has, his pain and their pains, and so on. But I think we have so many things to collect ourselves and to address our subjects and to move on, because at the end of the day, the Syrian diaspora is a part and rooted of the German society, and it should work on that.
Yeah, I had to think, because at the very beginning, Bayan, you mentioned also the Rwandan diaspora in Germany, right? And if we look back, then during the Rwandan genocide and the reconciliation that was done there, this was also an extremely long process, and I think reconciliation is never achieved. There's no end point to it, right? It's always a process. You will reach a level, and in Rwanda, it never really reached the end of it, and there is no end of it. But also, then if you look at Cambodia, I mean, those examples where extreme violence, extreme sectarianism, but there is a process for that, but I think that's never kind of perfect. And I wonder, it's like, and I started thinking that way when I thought about that, and then I heard also, I remembered your first slide, Amar, about how close everything is, right? Between Cairo and Homs, a couple of hundred kilometers, this is nothing, right? But then I was also thinking about the artificial borders and things. So maybe the solution. So, because Salam, I want to challenge you. It's like, is it really about building a Syrian national identity, or is the problem that actually the concept of Syria as a nation is something that has been assigned by the colonial powers? So there is no way of this is not Syria. Syria is an invention by the colonial powers. So wouldn't the solution not be like create a national identity, because there is not really a nation, but have kind of tried to build like more a federation, something like that, with where there's large autonomy for different regions, for different groups, where they can live together. I mean, something that is in discussion between Palestine and Israel as well. But some groups, we had a webinar on this actually, on a federation and federation idea. So how do you think about that? Is that really like, is there a path to kind of Syrian national identity, or is maybe the other path to a kind of regional federation identity that is much more than trying to fit everything into like a one drawer, or one kind of artificially drawn map? I see everyone unmuting, so
It's
that's
a
good.
big no no it's a big it's a big question, I guess. I don't know if we can answer it in 4 minutes, but I just want to say something very, very quick. First of all, Syria is not a colonial invention. Syria is there before history. What Syria in its current border, it
Borders,
is. So it was Greater Syria. It included Palestine, included Lebanon.
Exactly.
So Syria is, before history is there. And the issue of national identity, it's rooted in the Syrian history, and it's rooted in imperialism, colonialism, and authoritarianism. So, as I said in my talk, because since the after the independence from the French mandate slash occupation in 1946, Syrians came to themselves saying, "Oh, who we are? Are we Syrian? Are we Arab? Are we Muslims?" So the question of identity has been always there, and there was like main three identities created Syrian national identities, which is Arab national identity and Islamic identity as well. Each competed for power at a particular historical moment. Hafez al-Assad, when he came to power in 1970, he created kind of an umbrella identity under which, would come Islamic identity and Syrian identity. So Arab nationalism, it was the umbrella identity during Hafez al-Assad's era. Why he did this? Because he aimed at regime building. Why he did this? Because he aimed at his survival. And he relied on al-Asabiyya, Ibn Khaldun's brilliant theory of group solidarity. So I guess the issue of national identity is always been there, and it was not addressed, and it's time to address it. And as I said, high ideology won't construct a sustainable identity and an inclusive one. And I will stop here. So I see we have only 2 minutes, so maybe other would like to comment. I see.
Thank you very much. Super exciting answer. Yes, love. Yeah.
Just one thing. That's true that Syria and its current border, it is like post-colonial modern state, let's say. But the Syrian the national identity was actually enforced by an authoritarian regime by Assad, and this is why it is not like this national identity. And we have to say that within the during the war, the national identity became very weak because the people cannot identify themselves with the regime, and as a representative for the identity, this is why there's it was like a kind of a crisis, identity crisis for a lot of Syrians during this. And the new regime was a hope that that will be solved, but actually it actually created a new crisis of identity because they didn't identify, they didn't wear, they weren't like inclusive for everyone, or it is attracting everyone in there. But we have to be careful about identity and federalism. We can Germany is have a German identity, but we have a lack of federalism. So it is two different things, and can not the same level. So
100%.
yeah, we can be Syrian, all of us, and we have a confederation. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Interesting. And also, confederation doesn't necessarily mean everything works well. There's a confederation, and then the post-Yugoslavian states like Bosnia Herzegovina has also a lot of problems, right? I mean, there's another example where reconciliation, but further north, actually had, also is not finished after 20, 25 years of a bloody war. So yeah, it's super interesting, and I think we actually need to close. So, but there's a lot of food for thought in there, and I took a lot of notes. And we had a lot of questions, and I really found it very inspiring. I'm very grateful to all of you. I'm grateful for Amelie for organizing this. I'm grateful to the interpreters for interpreting this. It must have been difficult because we have all been talking quite fastly. So I think that wasn't that an easy challenge. But I found it inspiring. I found it very, thought-provoking as well. And I hope the audience did as well, but I have a feeling they did. And that's all for me to say. I wish you all the best. And I mean, I would just want to echo what Amar said at the very beginning about, being in thoughts also with the people suffering in the region, suffering in Syria, suffering in the whole escalation in Iran and around. And I think that's also something that we should never forget. And if we think about, if we talk about geopolitics, there are always people suffering. And there, every single person that's suffering is one person too many. And I think that's something we should never forget in those discussions. And I'm very grateful for you that we all did this together, I think, and had a very, very good discussion that was really fit for the moment. So thank you very much. When you are interested in more webinars, we will have one tomorrow that's actually kind of related to it, but we will speak about energy and the effects of the war in Iran on energy prices, on dependencies on energy. And this is at $1,800. Tomorrow is only in German, I'm afraid. But I posted a link there for all the German speakers. If they're interested, you can join us. So do join us at the next Europe Calling. Thank you all very much for our guests and have a nice evening. Bye bye.